loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we talk to preeminent scholar, author, and historian Dr. Gerald Horn to discuss stories in the mainstream media and Congress that large swaths of the black community in the United States were persuaded not to vote for Hillary Clinton by a troll farm in Russia reviving an old racist Cold War narrative. And then, because it's Thursday, we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump's surprise announcement yesterday that he would pull all U.S. troops out of Syria has ignited a firestorm of opposition among the political elite. Democrats, even those who were historically anti-war, have joined Republicans in their outrage that the United States might, quote, lose, unquote, Syria. Next, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue announced this morning that he would unilaterally tighten work requirements related to food stamps, a move that threatens hundreds of thousands of people's access to the most basic of necessities. Then, despite ongoing negotiations, North Korea continues to suffer under a near-total economic blockade imposed by the United States and other world powers. This has had a devastating effect on the North Korean people, and now even their efforts to mitigate the damage through scientific research is being demonized as an nefarious military plot. And then it's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And finally, a federal jury yesterday found a former Blackwater security contractor guilty of murder in the 2007 shootings of dozens of unarmed Iraqi civilians. This was the second time that former sniper Nicholas Slatton had been found guilty in the case. The first verdict was overturned. This comes as Donald Trump is intervening in the case of Green Beret Major Matthew Goldstein, who admitted to carrying out a summary execution of an Afghan prisoner.
And in other headlines, the U.S. government criticized Chinese trade and intellectual property practices at a high-profile press conference conducted by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. The U.K. also joined the condemnation, and other U.S. allies are expected to as well. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said today that the Trump administration is hoping for another summit between U.S. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim in early 2019. Pompeo has visited North Korea four times in 2018. Two active-duty Air Force members filed suit against the Defense Department and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis for discharging them from the military after they tested positive for HIV. Last year, they tested positive during screenings, were treated by doctors, and were declared physically fit to deploy. Then, last month, the two airmen got word that they were being discharged. A court ruled against Harvey Weinstein today, rejecting his motion to dismiss the criminal case against him. His defense team said that the case alleging sexual assault against two women was tainted by police and prosecutorial misconduct, but the judge stated that there is, quote, no basis for the defendant's claim. The House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed the First Step Act today. The bill is a high-profile prison reform law supported by both Democratic and Republican politicians, as well as President Trump. The House vote was 358 in favor and 36 opposed. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the allegation that Russia meddled in the 2016 election vis-a-vis an effort, a concerted effort, as it's called, to influence the voting patterns of the African-American community. The New York Times reported earlier this week that Russia made an extraordinary effort in 2016 to influence the votes of African-Americans using an array of tactics to suppress voter turnout among Democrats and unleashing what it called a, quote, blizzard of activity, close quote, on Instagram. But the implication of the article harkens back to the, quote, bad old days of segregation. It revives the racist narrative that African-American voters are so gullible to outside agitators that they effectively have no control over their own lives, their own votes, their own communities. We're joined in the studio by Dr. Gerald Horn, Dr. Horn is a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many, many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Dr. Gerald Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
When you saw these big headlines, not new headlines in the sense that we're talking again, but with a new sort of variation or a new iteration, a new theme about Russia's meddling, what was your reaction? And then as you read the story and followed this, what's the conclusion that you come to?
Well, it's just unmitigated gall on the part of Washington. Now, here you have a government in Washington, D.C. that has made a habit and practice of overthrowing sovereign states, be it in Iran in 1953 or Guatemala in 1954 or Chile in 1973. The list is endless. And yet it has the gall to complain about purported and alleged social media posts, which Nate Silver, the electoral guru, said amounted to about 0.1% of what was posted on Facebook and Instagram during the relevant period. Interestingly enough, Chris Matthews of Hardball, who, as you know, is no political genius, pointed out that when there are those who suggest that black voter turnout went down in 2016, that might have had something to do with the fact that Barack Obama was not on the ticket. It might have had something to do with the fact that Hillary Rodham Clinton was not necessarily a favorite of the black community in light of her critiques and attacks of black youth, calling them super predators, which led to a confrontation, you might recall, at a campaign soiree with Black Lives Matter activists. And this whole notion of outside agitators, which is how Moscow is being portrayed, helps to revive and resuscitate the worst metaphors of the bad old days of Jim Crow, as you suggested in your opening. It's as if the black community cannot think for itself. It needs Moscow to remind it that it should be upset about police killings and police terror and execution without due process of law. But more than this, this recent dust-up in Washington touches upon a very sensitive point, which understandably the mainstream media has neglected, which is that because the black community is treated so horribly and so terribly, there is a long history of black Americans collaborating with the real and imagined foes of the United States of America. I need only point out what happened in August 1814 during the War of 1812, when enslaved Africans collaborated with the Redcoats in helping to burn down the White House in Washington, D.C. itself, sending the diminutive James Madison, the U.S. president, and his garrulous spouse, Dolly, scurrying into the streets one step ahead of the posse. And so what I would advise the Senate is if they're really concerned about interference in black community electoral affairs, what they should do is reduce the level of white supremacy and Jim Crow and racism that still lingers. And then presumably this black community would have little incentive to watch videos, actually real videos, showing police beating up and terrorizing black people.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. I think this is an important point, the one that you're the last point that you were making. After World War II and after the Cold War had begun in earnest, when the U.S. and the Soviet Union, or the U.S.-led capitalist camp and the Soviet-led socialist bloc camp, were at loggerheads and competing internationally into almost in every country, important forces within the black civil rights movement and the black left in particular attempted to go and did go to the United Nations to try to make the claim that what was happening to black people was both a kind of genocide, a violation of internationally recognized human rights. There was an appeal and a feeling that on the international arena, there was some hope. That within the United States itself, there had seemed to be such an array of forces against the black community and against black freedom and against equality that getting allies internationally was important. There was the campaign, We Charge Genocide, the crime of government against the Negro people. William Patterson, one of the leaders of the Civil Rights Congress, the CRC, went to the United Nations. And, you know, interestingly, 3 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court passed the Brown versus Board of Education beginning the process where sectors of the American political elite, in this case, begowned lawyers who are our Supreme Court, took the initiative or responded to the initiative of the NAACP to actually start to do something for black people living in apartheid.
You are correct. And the Supreme Court, in its majority opinion, actually referenced the international situation as a reason for retreating from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow in the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education. And of course, there was a companion Washington, D.C. decision, Bowling versus Sharp, given the unique status of Washington. And it, too, referenced the international situation. You mentioned the Civil Rights Congress. Of course, I wrote a book about the Civil Rights Congress. I wrote a book about William Patterson, who was the leader. And of course, Paul Robeson, the great campaigner, was the moving force behind this genocide campaign. And for his efforts, his passport was snatched. Patterson, of course, was jailed. The Civil Rights Congress was driven into liquidation by the so-called Subversive Activities Control Board, a now fortunately departed U.S. government agency. And Robeson himself barely escaped prison as well. Now, what's interesting, once again, to return to this theme of hypocrisy and gall, is that as we speak, the Voice of America and various other U.S. government agencies are blaring to the four corners of the planet stories about supposed internment of Uyghurs and Muslims in China. The United States government also makes a big to-do about alleged persecution of the Arab minority in Iran. The U.S. government, particularly the discredited Radio Marti, has numerous stories supposedly detailing the discrimination against black people in Cuba. And yet, no one is allowed to talk about what's happening to black people in the United States of America. I mean, are these people really serious? What's interesting is that another commentator that I read suggested that the black community is underserved. Apparently, they're not familiar with the Radio Sputnik. And that if the U.S. mass media were really concerned about this purported Russian interference, they would trumpet far and wide what's happening to black people in terms of police terror in particular, and then there would be less incentive for black activists to be reading Instagram and Facebook posts from these mythical Russian agencies that apparently have tentacles that reach right into the heart of Anacostia.
Indeed. We had during the Cold War, the campaign that the United States launched. It was part of the, again, part of the anti-Soviet Cold War. And I think it's important to remind our audience, especially younger people, you know, when the first time I was handing out anti-war leaflets when I was 15 in the 1960s against the Vietnam War, people drove by and yelled, "Go back to Russia." And I was like, "What does that mean?" Because I wasn't political. I was just against the war in Vietnam. And I didn't really understand. A year later, maybe by the time I was 16, I did understand that everybody was at that time identifying Russians or the Soviet Union as the cause of all of America's problems, including when people wanted to stand up and speak out against the war in Vietnam, that was sort of a Russian-Soviet plot. This is a tried and true tactic. And now, of course, the Soviet Union is gone. Russia is not a communist country. It's not led by a communist party. It doesn't profess socialist ethics or socialist values internationally. But nonetheless, it's part of the political DNA of the United States when it's trying to target its enemies. Anybody who stands up to U.S. policy at home, complains about police violence at home, complains about the mass incarceration system at home, or who questions U.S. foreign policy.
Well, it's not only that. Here in Washington, there is a disconnect with reality. That is to say that those who rule this alleged republic find it difficult to acknowledge that what has helped to place the United States in a disadvantageous position globally was precisely what they celebrate. I'm speaking of the Cold War and the focus and targeting of the Soviet Union. That is to say, as a result of Cold War Red Scare policies, Washington felt compelled to try to destabilize labor unions, particularly left-led labor unions like the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union in the West Coast led by Harry Bridges, for example, the National Maritime Union, whose second-in-command Ferdinand Smith was a Jamaican of African origin. And that helped to simultaneously destabilize labor education programs, which then made a significant portion of the working class more vulnerable and susceptible to the blandishments of a con man and a buffoon known as one Donald Trump, who now the mass media, at least MSNBC, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, are up in arms against. But they rarely go back and look at how they may have contributed to the rise of Donald J. Trump domestically. And then globally, the U.S. ruling class made this deal with China, which has been described as a stroke of genius on the part of Richard M. Nixon when he went to Beijing. But the payoff was massive direct foreign investment into China. Just the other day, President Xi Jinping marked and celebrated the 40th anniversary of the so-called opening initiated by Deng Xiaoping, his predecessor, in 1978. And that has helped to create this juggernaut that has led now Washington to try to jeopardize its own economy by initiating a trade war. In response, the stock market is tanking as a direct result of this attack on China, whose economy is very well integrated into the economy in the United States, particularly in terms of supply chains. It's leading particularly to a hammering of the stock of Apple. But once again, rather than go back and say, you know what, maybe that decision with China was not in the best interest of U.S. imperialism, no, they just, Mr. Trump actually, in some senses, has a united ruling class with regard to this China initiative. So once again, I would urge and caution those who are in charge of this so-called republic to pay attention to reality, to pay attention to the lessons of history before they are swept off, quote, center stage, to use the term that President Xi Jinping uses quite frequently, and including in his speech the other day, to describe where China is headed, center stage.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. Dr. Horn, and we're talking about, in this segment, we're talking about the allegations made the top news this week, alarming headlines that Russia not only meddled in general in the 2016 election, not only hacked the Podesta emails, not only, none of these are proven to be true, in fact, but just saying, not only did all these other things, but in fact, it had a nefarious effort to target African-American voters, to convince African-American people not to come out and vote. And as a consequence, their efforts, the Russian efforts, were such that Donald J. Trump is, in fact, the president of the United States. Now, Dr. Horn, let's talk about what actually did happen. And this is how we started in the 2016 election. I'm looking at the number. How many people voted? Well, 138 million Americans voted in 2016. That's a lot of people, but it's only 58% of the voting age population. That means that 42% of the voting age population didn't vote. In general, more affluent communities vote, people who have more time on their hands. Poor people, in particular, low-income people, have the hardest time. The elections are on a Tuesday, on a work day. They're never on a holiday. There's all kinds of laws based on different state, the construction of state laws for voting, many of which require people to show up with an ID. Voting polls are shut down and have been shutting down, especially in black and brown communities. You go into the heart of the black community, say in Cleveland, we saw this multiple times, where the line stretched on and on and on. People had to wait literally 3, 4, 5 hours to vote. And then you'd go to a nearby suburban, mainly white, mainly middle class voting booth, voting polls, and, you know, hardly any wait. There's all these things that keep people from voting in America. But one thing that was very noticeable in the last election is that 6 million fewer Democrats voted than had voted in 2012 or 2008 when Barack Obama was on the ballot. And this, I think, speaks volumes about what really happened because, one, Donald Trump lost the popular vote by 3.5 million. He lost a few states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and by a slim margin. And if the same number of Democrats had voted in 2016 as had voted in 2012, he would not have won those states. Now, that includes a lot of black people. Let's go back and talk about the various factors and think about the Russian intervention as, let's assume it's true, not conceding it's true, but let's assume it's true. Could it possibly explain this disparity, this under voting by Democrats in those states?
That's a real stretch. It's interesting. When I read the headline in the New York Times just a day or two ago about this report that suggests that alleged Russian interference affected, quote, African Americans, that was in page one, lead story, New York Times. And first of all, I was shocked to see African Americans in the page one lead story in the New York Times.
Finally.
Secondly, the question of voter suppression. I thought that the issue would be voter suppression in Dixie, what has motivated Stacey Abrams, the black woman who was cheated out of the gubernatorial seat in Atlanta because of machinations by her opponent, Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, who was elected governor, which has led to a massive lawsuit on her part. I thought it might have a reference to the fact that just this week in the state of North Carolina, in the capital in Raleigh, that the state legislature overturned a veto by Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and helped to install voting ID to go to the polls. And this is North Carolina, where supposedly they're so concerned about voter fraud, and yet they ignore the harvesting of absentee ballots, which is going to lead to that most extraordinary of events, the rerunning of a congressional election because of serious and perceptive allegations that harvesting fraudulently absentee ballots helped to push a Republican over the finish line. I thought as well that some of our, quote, friends, unquote, would have been more perceptive in terms of analyzing this story. I mean, for example, I was disappointed with the statement of the Congressional Black Caucus, which seemed to swallow in whole, if not in part, this story about Russian interference. I thought that the CBC would be much more concerned about these stories of voter suppression in Dixie in particular. I was disappointed by the NAACP statement as well, although I salute them for pointing out that we would do well to look at the employment record of Facebook and Twitter and Alphabet, Google, YouTube, with regard to their paltry number of black American employees, which is quite frankly scandalous. I was also taken aback by the op-ed in the Washington Post by Sherilyn Ifill, the president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, who sought to suggest that people should be concerned about this issue because this shows how Russia is interfering, quote, in our democracy, quote unquote. I was disappointed that she has not realized that the Cold War is over and those sorts of appeals and those sorts of cries carry less and less weight with every passing day. But in any case, I would hope that Marsha Fudge of the Congressional Black Caucus, who cut a deal with Nancy Pelosi in order that she not challenge Nancy Pelosi to be speaker, as now has a new committee on voting that she said it, that she would look into some of these stories that I'm talking about. That is to say, voter suppression in North Carolina, voter suppression in Georgia, inadequate and actually malfunctioning voting machines in black communities in particular. And that, it seems to me, is a more fruitful path for the United States of America. Because if the United States of America, which it says it will, continue to interfere in the internal affairs of virtually every state on the planet, using means mostly foul, it can hardly complain when there are stories about people posting Instagram posts about police misconduct. I mean, what kind of hypocrisy is this?
Indeed. Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. I want to go back to that New York Times. When you really actually parse the words, because getting past the headline or the impression that the article leaves and getting into the words,
which is always the case.
It's always the case.
Yep.
And it's really important. Here's what it says about this massive Russian interference that maybe had an impact on black voting patterns in 2016. The Internet Research Agency, that's the St. Petersburg troll farm, also created a dozen websites. That's 12. Disguised as African American in origin with names like BlackMattersUs.com, Blacktivist.info, BlackedOlive.org, and BlackSouls.us. On YouTube, the largest share of Russian material covered the Black Lives Matter movement and police brutality with channels called Don't Shoot and Black to Live. Okay, so a dozen websites. I thought this was like the dominant. Anyway, and it doesn't say that it told people when it had these dozen websites were protesting against police violence against black people that, by the way, don't go vote for Hillary Clinton.
Right.
I don't think that's there.
Well, what's interesting is that it's so notorious that Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign was insufficient that on the most recent broadcast of Saturday Night Live, where they had this alternative universe where Trump didn't get elected and Hillary Rodham Clinton did get elected, the comedian on the show said that she got elected because she chose to visit Wisconsin. You might recall that it was quite notorious that she didn't visit the state that she lost. At the same time, there is this complaint about black voters in Milwaukee not turning out to push her across the finish line. This is like lunatic thinking, I'm afraid to say. It's the looniest idea since Looney Tunes.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. Dr. Horn, the website New Knowledge, the organization, which seems to be very thin. I looked at their website, and they said they have decades of experience, but that's if you put the entire staff in an aggregate together, because most of them are in their early 30s, it looks like. They write, quote, "There are very real racial tensions and feelings of alienation do exist in America."
No kidding.
"And have for decades."
You're kidding.
It goes back all the way to decades. Not centuries. It goes back decades. The IRA, the Internet Research Agency, didn't create them. It exploits them. Close quote. Okay, that's the kind of scholarship that we have and the kind of depth of reporting. The fact of the matter is, if Hillary Clinton had, as you said, decided to go once to Wisconsin, it may have made a difference. Governor Walker, the Republican, won the election. She lost the primary to Bernie Sanders, but she didn't go because she didn't expect to lose. Donald Trump didn't expect to win. Nobody was actually on the Democratic side that excited, either because Hillary Clinton is a lousy candidate or she promised that nothing in America would change. In the whole campaign with Bernie Sanders, she said, no, none of that's realistic. Or third, they thought it was in the bag for Hillary Clinton. Why vote? Why go wait 3 hours in line when you know the outcome already? It seems to me that's more likely. Anyway, we have 1 minute left. Let's have you take us out.
Well, I think you have a point. I mean, Senator Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton, obviously had many demerits on her record, not least of which was the disastrous and catastrophic overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya in 2011. Recall, according to the memoir literature, that supposedly Pentagon Chief Robert Gates was opposed, that U.S. President Barack Obama was opposed, but the hawk, Hillary Rodham Clinton, was able to manipulate the situation and league with Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor / Ambassador to the United Nations, and of course Samantha Powers, the Ambassador to the United Nations, to help to engineer what has turned out to be one of the most catastrophic episodes in the disastrous history of U.S. foreign policy. There are many in the black community who are still upset with this overthrow in 2011, including myself, I might add. And so rather than look at that kind of history, it seems that Washington is more concerned about finding an excuse for Mr. Trump being elected. They're trying to find an excuse everywhere except where they should be looking, which is into the disastrous policies of the wing of the U.S. ruling class that they help to misrepresent.
That's the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn was with us in studio today. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having us on the show.
So, guys, there was something we ran out of time last time we wanted to talk about. We have time now. Let's start off with it. This is the issue of Santoya Brown. Santoya Brown was a teenager who had been forced into prostitution. She was 16 when she killed a man in Nashville, Tennessee, who had solicited her for sex. She believed this man was going to rape her. The prosecution argued that she was trying to rob this guy, and she was sentenced to life without parole. She appealed that, and the decision was made just last week that she is entitled to parole because she was a teenager when this event took place, but she has to serve 51 years in prison before she's eligible for parole. Kevin, start us off with this.
Yeah, so we got to say a little bit last week, but we really didn't get into this issue of how she's been seen as this kind of victim of sex trade or prostitution. And I think, well, a lot of the focus is this sentence of how it becomes, you know, okay, so 51 years now that she would have to serve before she could be freed. I think a lot of what is happening in this case does stem from our stigmas around sex workers and the way in which we handle this. And there's this really great piece that was done a year ago in the appeal by Miriam Kaba, who's a good prison abolition, prisoner's rights activist, and Britt Schulte, who wrote about just the way in which everyone puts her into this frame of being this kind of a victim. But they say that, like, you know, we have to understand that there's a way in which people are trying to survive when they're poor and working class. And while there is real and actual abuse that Santoya probably experienced, there's also the fact that she's engaging in these acts that put her in the situation where she was abused because she needs to pay and have some way to survive and live. And so, you know, essentially, I think that one of the real downfalls of this case is that she's in this position because she was poor and people don't do anything to help out people like Santoya, so that they don't have to do this in order to survive.
Paul, she was 16 years old when this happened. Isn't it true that physicians, that psychiatrists have determined that at that age, where your brain is not fully formed, you cannot be responsible for something like this, especially in the event where she's taken into this man's bedroom, she sees guns all over the place, she believes that he's threatening and that he's going to kill her. Where was the criminal intent here? Isn't this really about a crime against a child?
I think there's that. I think there's a couple of things, one of which is, I think my recollection of the facts of the case is, I think the state alleged that the victim, that the guy she shot, was asleep at the time she shot him. But I think that one of the things that this case highlights, as you mentioned, is, I think, you know, recent research has shown, in some respects, funny, we need, here we are in 2018, and we need scientific research to show the thing about children not being able to form criminal intent. But 2,000 years ago, the Roman Empire had what they called the 777 rule, which was that, you know, children under 7 were presumed to be incapable of forming criminal intent. Under 14, it was limited. And under 21, it was limited as well. And so, you know, 2,000 years later, we're kind of rediscovering that. And I think that it's funny because, you know, we recognize that children aren't mature. We generally believe that children aren't mature enough to make a lot of decisions, whether it's from voting, joining the military, drinking alcohol, driving, yet somehow they're presumed to have full criminal responsibility for their actions. I think that one of the things that's kind of getting, I think, overlooked in this is how draconian and how out of step the United States is with the rest of the world when it comes to its criminal sentencing. Because I think that in some respects, I think that, you know, focusing on, you know, whether or not Santoya was, you know, whether she had a valid self-defense claim, which the jury rejected or not, I think kind of overlooks the point of she was 16 years old, she got a sense of life without parole. And the United States is one of the few countries in the world that has life without parole sentences. So even if she were guilty in any other country, she would not have served. She would not have gotten a sentence like that. And the fact that in this country, in Tennessee, a 51-year in prison sentence, so that she would be eligible for release when she's 67, this is deemed, you know, the mercy sentence, better than the alternative. And when you consider the fact that in China the maximum sentence is 20 years, in Canada it's 25 years, In most European countries, it's going to be anywhere between 15 and 30 years. I think that's one of the things that I think points to the need for, you know, revamping the entire sentencing structure in this country. And, you know, all too often, judges and prosecutors engage in these actuarial calculations of how old is the defendant and how long are they likely to live in prison. And those are the sentences that they mete out. And I think that's one of the things that's kind of getting overlooked here.
Young kids, 15 years old, 16 years old, nobody is deciding, hey, I want to sell my body for sex.
Right.
This is a criminal enterprise where people are trafficking in children. You know, that's the reality. And of course, it's only poverty that would require any child to go along with that or to be forced to go along with that. So we have a lot of different layers to this thing. You know, she is a victim. She's a child. She's a kid. And then she's also in a precarious situation all the time because she's meeting strangers and having to engage in sex with them. And some of these strangers are older people. Like this guy is a full-blown adult male who has weapons. We don't know the details of what actually happened. We don't know the details. But on every level, it seems to me that she is a victim, that Santoya is a victim. She was a victim because she was a child. She's a victim because she was given a long prison sentence. She's a victim now because, unlike rich people who commit all kinds of crimes, including governmental crimes, when they send other young people to go kill people in other countries, like in wars of aggression, like the Iraq War, they go around, make lots of money, and they're treated as solid citizens, and we listen to them, and later on, they become rehabilitated.
And you know what's sick, too? What's sick is that she's not the only person in the prison system that's like this. This happens to hundreds, maybe thousands of women across the country.
Yeah.
Well, and I think one of the things that you know, I think people are kind of losing sight of is, you know, guilty or innocent, you know, regardless of that, the woman's already served 23 years in prison. And in the rest of the world, that's deemed a pretty heavy sentence. I mean, it's one of the things that's interesting is when I was in prison, I corresponded with political prisoners in different parts of Europe. And one gentleman, his name is Jean-Marc Royan, and he was indignant about the fact that he'd been sentenced to 20 years in prison for assassinating the head of the French military weapons program and a couple others. And his point was child murderers don't get that much time in France. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, we just don't realize just how far out of whack American sentencing is with the rest of the world. And I think until we start, and I think that's one of the things too, is when we look at how did the American prison population jump from 1 million people in cages in 1990 to 2 million people in cages in 10 years later in the year 2000, it wasn't that we had some sudden crime wave. It wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, America went off the rails and a bunch of crimes were committed. It's because our sentences were lengthened. And, you know, to put this in context, for over 100 years in California, the sentence for a first-degree murder conviction was 7 to life. So that after 7 years, people were deemed, you know, were deemed to be evaluated for release.
Yes.
And then they extended that to 25 years to life, and the governor has to personally approve the release, which led to, you know, predictably led to, you know, a slowdown in releases, with some governors like Democrat Gray Davis saying they were going to release anyone from prison. So, you know, so I think that this whole trend, too, is also not only is it unique to America, but it's also a relatively recent trend. It's only something that started in like the last 30 years, and that's what's blown up our prison population, is this trend towards these draconian, lengthy prison sentences.
Before we go into the next issue, I want to close by saying that there's an interesting postscript to this case. There was a longtime litigator for the Tennessee Attorney General's office named Preston Shipp, who had begun teaching free classes at the Tennessee Prison for Women. He met Santoya Brown there. She took some of his classes. They became friendly. And he realized that most of the women who were incarcerated in this prison and who were there on life sentences really were redeemable and in many cases had been redeemed, but were just simply doomed to die in prison because the Tennessee system didn't allow them parole until they served their 51 years. He was going through some of his personal papers and he realized that he had written a legal opinion that was instrumental in keeping Santoya Brown in prison. And so he resigned as a prosecutor and is now working for the defense. Now, with that aside, I want to go on to the new sentencing reform bill that the Senate passed overwhelmingly this week. It's going to be considered in the House next week, Christmas week, in a lame duck session. The Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, has already agreed to send it to the floor for a vote under great pressure from the White House. So, Kevin, I'm hearing a lot of complaints about this from the left, that it doesn't go far enough. But then I'm hearing a lot of complaints from the right, from the likes of Tom Cotton et al., saying that it's a get-out-of-jail-free card for violent felons. So is this a good bill or is this a bad bill?
Well, I think that if I was going to ask for Tom Cotton's opinion, I would be asking the wrong person, because I think he's an unhinged person who probably, and I mean this honestly, probably needs some mental health treatment for what he's experienced. I mean, you know, he's a warmonger, and I think that he's probably has psychopathic tendencies that need help from, and needs help from some kind of an institution. So he's been one of the key people to push this idea that we are going to be letting offenders out and they're going to run amok, and there's going to be so much terror in the streets that it's going to be like the purge and people are going to be in trouble. And I think that that's obviously an exaggeration and it's not based in reality. Of course, it's steeped in the tough on crime kind of politics that has had a stranglehold over the United States for the last decades. But breaking out of that, I think that's what we're seeing here with these criminal justice reform groups that are pushing this legislation. And I do think what's interesting is the name of the legislation itself has actually become a way of talking about this that admits that it does not go far enough, but also admits that this is a starting point that could be useful. And so I've been really highly critical when we've done our program and talked about the First Step Act, and I've amplified what the ACLU, the Brennan Center for Justice, these other groups and organizations are saying about what's inadequate. But I do note that there are senators and there are representatives who we normally think don't go far enough who are saying in their statements of support for the First Step Act that this is the first step and that we recognize it as the first step. And that is exactly why it's called the first step. And people like even Senator Rand Paul are saying, well, this can only be a beginning. There's so much more that needs to be done with this legislation. So you have that. I think there's, because you have the competing interests of progressives versus Republicans, and we know how it's a sausage-making factory for legislation when it goes through Congress, and you've got a lot of different competing interests to try to get some kind of a bill that can get the votes to pass through, that you see jostling, and you've got interests that are competing against each other. You've got the industries for digital incarceration and alternatives to incarceration that want to profit. So you have that.
I think the First Step Act is just that, a good first step. And I think that we shouldn't underestimate its significance, because I think one of the things we need to keep in mind is I think in American history, the closest things that we've had that can even be remotely framed as being pro-prisoner or progressive when it comes to prisoners' rights or prisoners' well-being at the federal level, I believe, is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the Religious Land Use and Incarcerated Persons Act, and the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And basically, and in a lot of respects, those were really, I think, minimalistic laws in the sense of our LUPA only applied to the religious rights of prisoners, and the Prison Rape Elimination Act, despite the lofty name of the law, is basically just a data collection act. It doesn't do anything to actually stop rape in prison. So to the extent that the First Step Act is actually kind of doing something, I think the fact that it's however minimal, minuscule, tiny baby steps and ineffective it may prove to be in the bigger picture, the bigger scheme of things, the fact that it's happened at all, I think, is one of those things that I think is, very significant about it. So, I think that's one of the things that, we should keep in mind about this is that, yeah, it's exactly that, a good first step. I think the bigger thing, though, is what no one is talking about is no one is talking about the need to repeal things like the 1994 Crime Control Act, which, among other things, enacted and gives states billions of dollars a year for changing their sentencing laws and making prisoners serve up to 85% of their sentences. massively expanded the federal death penalty. Then there's the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which made it very difficult, if not impossible, for prisoners to successfully sue over their conditions of confinement. You know, these were all the laws that were enacted during the Clinton administration that doubled our prison population between 1990 and 2000. And sadly, no one's talking about repealing those laws or undoing them, just try to undo the damage. So I think that's one of the things that, I think as John noted, yes, the First Step Act, like the name says, it's a good first step, but now we need to do, you know, we need to go down the rest of the path, because when they were building up the police state and massively inflating our prison population, doubling our prison population and stuff like that, there was no baby steps along the way. There were wide, sweeping, all-encompassing laws that did that, and they were massively successful, and the result is in the numbers. They doubled our prison population in 10 years. It took us over 200 years to lock up our first million people, and then it took us 10 years to lock up the second million.
You know, I want to ask you, too, as a follow-up, Paul, you cited all these different reform acts, these various pieces of legislation, and together they don't make one overall reformation. So this First Step Act, is this really a first step toward true reform, or are our legislators going to sit back on their heels and say, well, we just passed this incredible bill into law, the president's going to sign it, so on sentencing reform, our work is done?
I think that's hard to say, you know, because when it's come time to filling up our prison systems and building up the police state, you know, year after year after year, it was bill after bill after bill sailing through unanimously, creating new crimes, lengthening sentences for existing crimes, making prison conditions worse. And there was never, you know, there's never been an appetite for stopping that. In fact, that's one of the things that I think is often unreported is Joe Biden's role in the Senate. I think for, you know, so like the 30 years he was in the Senate and as vice president, you know, he's played a very significant role in almost single-handedly, you know, massively expanding our federal prison population and criminalizing a wide variety of acts and stuff like that. So when it's come time to building up the police state and our carceral population, you know, there's been no shortage of appetite and a willingness to do that. So whether this tiny baby step of very modest reform dampens their enthusiasm, our legislators' enthusiasm, I mean, that kind of remains to be seen. That said, you know, we still have not seen or are not seeing anything that's going to significantly reduce our prison population, that's going to significantly expand the rights of prisoners, or do anything about their conditions of confinement. No one's talking about doing anything that helps prisoners have better conditions, like really basic stuff like adequate medical care, a right to an education, mental health, adequate mental health care, things like that. For now, that's the realm of crazy talk.
That's the voice of Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul from Lake Worth, Florida. He's the founder of the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. We're also joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com and the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. We talked last week, John, about the fact that this show with Kevin and Paul has seemed to be singled out as an indicator of Kremlin taking, quote, some legitimate grievances, mm-hmm. close quote, and by simply having our broadcast that we're somehow interfering with America's democracy.
Yes, we're hurting democracy.
We're undermining the confidence that Americans have in their institutions.
Yes.
And Kevin Gostala, I know you're about to jump in. It's such a class-based formulation. I mean, in addition to being wrong and inaccurate, like working class and poor people do not think of the criminal justice system as being something that they would like to have or have any confidence in. Anyway, I know you are ready to jump in. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, I am, but I can't hold back. You know, we spent the last week suggesting that the reason why Black Americans had their votes suppressed was because of Russia. And that really ties into our criminal justice conversation, because they really do seem to think that they can ignore the sort of history and legacy of slavery and racism in this country, and anything that's being made an issue, whether it's us on this show talking about these systemic problems or whether it's in other forums or on other platforms, they really think that those must be coming to the surface, bubbling to the surface, because there's some foreign power adversary, whether it be Russia, Iran, or I don't know, Venezuela or some other country that's trying to stew debate and make us actually talk about things that we should be talking about. But what I was going to say to what John said about the First Step Act is that I think it really depends on whether you have politicians who think that there are systemic problems that need to be fixed. Because if you have someone like Mike Lee, who has, you know, as a libertarian, maybe done some decent stuff when it came to this kind of issue. But when he decides to say about the First Step Act that he's not sure that there's more fundamental changes that need to be made, that becomes very disappointing, because I think he's someone you're going to want in a coalition in order to pass meaningful legislation. Just knowing what we know about the political makeup of Congress, you're going to have to win those people over. So you need voices like Rand Paul, who are looking at drug offenses and saying that we can't just lock up people and throw away the key anymore. You need to have those people. But then I'd also flip it around and say, as far as the Democrats, you need to pay attention to the politics going into the 2020 election, unfortunately. And I think that's going to be, could be very detrimental to criminal justice reform advocates, especially to incarcerated individuals who are seeking some kind of relief, because Democrats may not want Donald Trump to win any kind of victory on this issue, because they know he'll claim credit for it and use it against
exactly.
him in the 2020 election. And so they may want it to just be this meaningless, because, you know, we know how the Democrats are. I mean, they're willing to let healthcare fall by the wayside so that they can use it as an issue against Donald Trump. They're willing to let other things go south so that they can use it as an issue against Donald Trump. And so, I expect criminal justice reform and its inadequacies to be a sort of thing that they want to keep around so that they can use it as a cudgel.
Paul, I want to move on to another issue. I had to chuckle when I saw this in Prison Legal News. It's entitled "Federal Prisons Use Nurses and Cooks as Guards While Officials Push to Fill Private Prisons." I laughed because I can't tell you how many times I was frisked by a secretary, by the dentist, by the chaplain, because they're always short of staff, always. And I remember the chaplain strip searching people, and I said, "Oh, chaplain," I said, "not you too." And he said, "Oh, what am I going to do?" He said, "We don't have enough people. They force us to do this."
Yeah, but they don't force them to keep working at that job. So, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, that's one of the things I find amazing is, you know, an agency that has like a $7 billion budget and they claim to be short-staffed, and then it comes down to, well, you know, what are they spending the money on? And you know, this is, and I think to an extent this is kind of like the perpetual ploy about, you know, claiming to be short-staffed when, yeah, they got plenty of money for other things. And so one of the things that we note in Prison Legal News is at the same time that, yeah, the BOP is claiming that they don't have the money to staff their own prisons, they're still hiring, or they're still sending thousands of federal prisoners over to private prisons.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that's the whole, you know, I think that's to an extent, that's the ideological factor here of, you know, the only reason they don't want to, you know, hire more guards in the BOP prisons, they figure they're going to be unionized and give money to the Democrats. So they'd rather, you know, they'd rather send the prisoners to private prisons that are a non-unionized workforce and have those bottom lines rather than ensure their own employees are adequately staffed. But, you know, it's also one of the things, too, as I have to say, is you know, based on my own prison experience, I've always gotten the impression that prisons tend to be overstaffed. And when you start looking at the breakdown of, you know, prison employees, I've been to the Bureau of Prisons headquarters in Washington, D.C., and I was amazed at how big the building was and how many employees they have literally shuffling papers.
Yeah, they aren't guarding anybody.
Yeah, and this plays itself out at the state level. A couple years ago, I was researching a story on good time credits in Connecticut, and by the time I was shuffled off, I think, to the fourth person who could presumably answer my question, I was getting kind of annoyed because I'm like, okay, look, this is a simple question about your good time credits. Why can't you connect me with the right person? And the person I was talking to said, you know, well, sir, We've got over 2,000 employees here in DOC headquarters in Hartford, so it's hard to find the right person. And I'm thinking, 2,000 people in your headquarters, you've only got 18,000 prisoners. You know, how much, that's like one bureaucrat shuffling paper for every 9 prisoners. How much paper shuffling can go on? And I think that's one of the things that, you know, when you start looking at the services that prisoners get, those have long been cut to the bone, if not eliminated. And you're back to the thing, you know, what are they doing with these billions of dollars?
Yeah, it's going down the drain. We have 1 minute left, Kevin. Why don't you take us out?
I think that we're at a critical juncture here for criminal justice reform. And I guess if I had to give any final thoughts, I would say that obviously what passed was not acceptable and that we care about all these issues. It's why we talk about them every week. It isn't just to destabilize America and stick it to the superpower and the elites, but I know we delight in doing that, don't we? But you know, we really have to be mindful of where of potential. There are lots of opportunities, I think, to create change. But you know, that's why we're going to keep doing this show, is so that we can be critical of reform advocates and where it's going, but also point to a lot of important injustices that need to be highlighted.
Indeed, that was the voice of Kevin Gastala, who joined us from Chicago. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were also joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.